Welcome back, everybody, to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm your host, Tony Black, and this week we are getting hot under the collar as we are tackling Fire, the 12th episode of Season 1 of The X-Files. I'm joined once again, after his appearance last week, by Mr. Lee Howard.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for having me back. Two in a row. Don't worry. I'll move aside and let someone else back on shortly. But it's good to be back.
It's great to have you back so soon after our look at Eve. And it's tending to be a bit of a trend that quite a few people tend to do two in the on the bounce.
Well, that fits in. Yeah, that fits in with the whole director for hire, because they often come in not necessarily with the X-Files, but like a standard of TV direction is that you'd get a named director in and they'd do two episodes back to back, and then somebody else will come over and take over the helm.
Well, there you go. Exactly. So we're following a good example. So let's not waste any time and get straight into the meat of the episode. Let's have a look at Fire.
So, Sherlock, is the game afoot?
Afraid so, Watson. But you're off the hook on this one.
What do you mean?
I mean, I'm not going to put you through this.
Put me through what?
Phoebe's little mind game.
What are you talking about?
Something else I haven't told you about myself, Scully. I hate fire. Hate it. I'm scared to death of it. When I was a kid, my best friend's house burned down. Had to spend the night in the rubble, keep away looters. For years, I had nightmares about being trapped in a burning building.
Wait, and Phoebe knows about this?
Oh, yeah, this is classic Phoebe Grain. Mind game player extraordinaire. 10 years it's taken me to forget about this woman, and she shows up in my life with a case like this.
So she shows up knowing the power she has over you, and then she makes you walk through fire, is that it?
Phoebe is fire.
Mulder, are you sure you don't want me to help you out on this one?
Sooner or later, a man's got to face his demons.
Fire. Dun, dun, dun. I don't know, I'm going to stop myself doing that all the way through.
There's lots of little puns, isn't there, in the episode itself as well.
Oh yeah, there's plenty. Fire is the 12th episode of the first season of The X-Files, and it first aired on December 17th, 1993, and was written solely by Chris Carter and directed by Larry Shaw, who had previously directed Fallen Angel in this his last episode as director on The X-Files. In this episode, Mulder must overcome a crippling phobia of fire in order to catch a killer with fire-controlling capabilities. So, what would you give Fire, Lee, out of 10?
So it's another Monster of the Week show, not tied in with the overarching grand narrative, like the mythology of the X-Files. It's so difficult because obviously we did another Monster of the Week show on the last occasion that I was speaking with you in Eve, and I do think that out of the two is the superior episode, and even Eve is inferior to what they were able to do with Tombs, in the very first kind of like Monster of the Week episode squeeze. So it's tough. They set the bar so high for themselves that I feel kind of like I'm doing the episode a disservice to give it a low rating. But I guess, if I'm generous, we could be just scratching a low 7, but really it's probably like a high 6.
Well, I mean, I think that is very generous. I mean, I think this is a 4.5. Personally.
Oh, wow.
maybe a 5 at best. I think because the problem I have with Fire is that for a lot of it, it really feels like the kind of X-File that would have been made if this show had been made in the cheesy 80s with other shows like, Airwolf and Knight Rider. It feels like a real sort of throwback to the kind of TV that the X-Files was a little bit better than that we'd had in previous years.
Yeah, it's certainly cheesy. There's a lot of humour, but I think, as we sort of alluded to when we spoke last time about Eve and maybe some of the other clunkier aspects of the episodes, for some reason that's part of their appeal for me now. So there is a huge sway in this episode towards like jocular humour and kind of banter, and then obviously the old flame, there's another pun, coming back into the story. And I guess if you don't get on board with that, and that can, I imagine it just brings the episode to a grinding halt for you.
Well, I just think that, The X-Files is great when it does comedy, when it's intending to do comedy, when it's when it's like, better comedic writers. Chris Carter, for all what he can do, he can't really write comedy, and he's proven that several times. And this is the first time for me he proves he can't write comedy, because most of the gags or most of the lines, I mean, it's not an outright comedy, but most of the lines he does throw in really, for me, fell on their face. And it just made the show what, you know, at this point, you know, you're 12 episodes in, you're trying to build an established rep of being a procedural show about mysteries and, you know, all this kind of stuff. You've already had a very uneven first, like, half of a season because of lots of different episodes, some of which have been great, some of which have been absolute trash. And now you come out with an episode which isn't terrible, you know, it's not among the worst of the season, but it's probably quite low down because...
Yeah, you're saying you're ranking this on par or just slightly above something like the Jersey Devil then, like another Monster of the Week show. Yeah,
I would. And I think it's got its plus points and it's got its things to save it, but I think on the whole, it really doesn't... On the one hand, it wants to be quite funny and charming and, you know, romantic and that kind of thing. And on the other hand, it wants to be quite nasty and quite vicious and quite, you know... brooding and, you know, with a whole thing of Mulder conquering a phobia. And it just doesn't fit. I just felt like it seemed like a very cheesy 80s cop show, you know. And I just, that's not what The X-Files is for me. So I have my issues with Fire, and it doesn't scorch me like it might. I'm going to do a lot of these. but, you know, each to their own. There are people out there. I mean, funnily enough, I think I remember liking this more when I was younger. And I will give full credit, and we'll get to talking about him, but full credit to Mark Shepherd, because he's definitely great all the way through as Cecil Lively, the monster of the week, so to speak.
And he's obviously got that unassailably cool ability of lighting his own cigarette. You know, that's awesome.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's a mixed bag, I think, altogether. It was an interesting, based on a few interesting ideas. Chris Carter based Mulder's boyhood experience of having to spend a night guarding from looters a friend's house, which had recently burnt down, on an incident that actually happened to Chris Carter himself. And he has a fear of fire, Chris Carter, so he thought he'd give this to Mulder. That's an interesting way of putting your own, you know, neuroses into a character you write. And he also wanted to bring back a former romantic interest for Mulder. He said he thought it'd be interesting to show a bit of Mulder's history by bringing back an old girlfriend, who obviously is the Scotland Yard detective Phoebe Green. And he always wanted to do that. He always wanted to do a female Scotland Yard detective. I wish he hadn't, if I'm honest. But
come on. Amanda Pays is hilarious in this. Like the total kind of lack of sparks, I guess, between her and Mulder is just cringeworthy in an amusing way. And I love the overdone accents. I mean, I think that's another part of the creakiness of the episode in itself, the fact that you open, you know, in what is being passed off as the English countryside, and you just hear like these really exaggerated English accents, and it just feels so unlike the X-Files. It's one of those scenarios where if you watch a lot of American TV, any kind of English accent, because obviously coming from the UK ourselves, just stands out a mile, and it just feels so wrong. So even though I think Shepherd's actual ancestry possibly has some Irish descent in it, even him speaking with his Irish accent, it's just like, oh no.
Oh yeah, it's quite painful, all that. It's interesting because James Wong said that there was a lot more in the script between Mulder and Phoebe than actually ended up on the screen. He said there was a lot more to their relationship in that script that just got cut or didn't translate through the performances or anything like that. So it would be interesting to read the original script for Fire and actually see what they did, because, you know, I won't lie that there was some kind of, I think, potential for that kind of relationship, but I think terribly executed. But we'll get to this. so it's, you know, there's a few areas that it was based on. It was also being written at the same time where there was a massive wildfire in Southern California. And they say it was a strange coincidence that fueled Chris Carter, because the wildfire was burning and it was big on the news in late 1993. Oh, okay. And he was writing this.
That's interesting, because I thought when you mentioned the fact that you felt it felt very 80s, I stumbled across the fact that Stephen King apparently is credited with coining the phrase like pyrokinesis, like the idea of like the psychic ability of somebody being able to create and control fire with their mind. Because, you know, obviously very much following on from kind of like Carrie, he did another novel called Firestarter, like about, you know, someone who has got this ability. And I think he was the one who introduced that pyrokinesis term into like the lexicon. And I thought, oh, right, is it from that then? Is that kind of almost a homage by Carter back to the 80s. But that probably makes more sense what you're saying, that he wrote what he knew, he wrote what was current at the time.
I don't have any doubt, though, that he had Stephen King in his mind, because he is a huge Stephen King fan. And in the end, Stephen King writes an episode of The X-Files in season 5. You know, so there is a there is a lot of Stephen King, I think, in Chris Carter's inspiration box, shall we say. So he probably had a fair bit of that in his mind as well. So it's a good fact to bring out. So yeah, there is some backstory. If we do start exploring the episode in general, I think. The big thing I was going to bring up about the teaser is what you've already said about the whole idea of, you know, this. It's just like the kind of Britain you only an American could write. You know, this old posh lord who walks out of his house, slowly ambles through his garden, and he's going, "Good morning, chaps. Oh, hello." I was just there going, what Britain is this?
If you hadn't seen it at the time, but going back and rewatching it, you're just praying for him to spontaneously combust.
Exactly.
And a hot blonde wife, isn't it? Like, you know, seeing him off.
What was that about? I know, because I clocked that she's like half his age at least. She's like old enough maybe to be his granddaughter. And he's like, "Goodbye, darling. What, I should be home for supper." I'm like, you dirty dog.
I mean, that ends up being, doesn't it, like part of... I mean, I don't think the plot is incredibly strong in this episode, in the sense that the idea is that the perpetrator, he sends like love letters, doesn't he? He seems to be targeting wealthy men that have got like these young sort of token brides, and somehow he's trying to strike up a relationship with them. But I don't... What happens then? Because obviously, presumably, he's had past victims, so he's got the men out of the way. I don't understand what happens then. Surely he would have achieved his aim of somehow getting the money and ingratiating himself into the life of the wife. But he seems to move from one to the other, we're led to believe. And then from country to country, because we quickly leave. I mean, is it Vancouver standing in as English countryside?
Yeah,
I
that's
don't know.
Right.
We suddenly move from there to America, don't we? For, I'm imagining, logistical reasons. But yeah, I can never quite understand why. You know, I'll call him Bob because I guess that's the persona he takes on when he gets to the States. I don't know why yet, like, he feels the need to necessarily do that. But anyway,
I think that's a really, really good point, because it's a big missing piece, I think, one of the things I'm going to bring up about Cecil Lively, who is the ultimate name of the guy, is that there is a lot we don't know about him. And I think that it does work to the strength of the episode, actually, in that he is a very mysterious figure, even by the end. But there is a big missing piece, I think, in terms of what he's actually wanting out of all this. And, you know, they try and describe it off as being, you know, part of a, you know, psychotic sort of sexualized murder spree kind of thing. But it, like you said, there is a missing piece in terms of what he's doing with the wives afterwards. And we obviously don't see any of that with, you know, the foxy young blonde, which is a bit odd. So I wondered about that as well. I also wondered if Bosham, which was the place this teaser takes place in, is a real place. And I did look it up, and it is a village in West Sussex near Chichester and the South Downs.
Oh, right, so sorry, it's a real place, but it's fictitiously represented. In other words, it wasn't shot there, was it?
No.
It was shot in Vancouver, yeah.
It would have been shot in Vancouver, and I think the bulk of the episode takes place in Cape Cod, Massachusetts.
Right,
or certainly
okay,
the
yes,
end, where
yes.
the Marsdens live, takes place in Cape Cod. So, yeah, but it would all be shot in Vancouver. But, yeah, it's... in Vancouver, that's the beauty of Vancouver, in that it can be anywhere, really. And that's one of the things they managed to do.
I mean, what I would say is, before we do move away from that cold open, I'm pleased it's there, not just obviously for the horrendously awkward accents, but because it had some brilliant stunt work. And I would say that really is a strength of the episode, going back and kind of watching it. Everything looks physical, like all the burn effects that, you know, there's obviously multiple of those, you know, just, you know, sets burning, but also like live action, you know, the actors burning. So it obviously would have been real stunt work, and that, I thought that looked really impressive to me.
Yeah, I thought the way that was all executed was great. You know, the way he dies is really sudden and horrible. It's physically powerful. It does, you know, pretty much make the point that yes, Mark Sheppard, whoever he is, has done this, you know, in the way it's directed. But yeah, I agree. I thought it was visceral and it was horrible, really. And after that kind of silly sort of, "Oh, hello, chaps," opening, it really kind of hits you in the nads. So yeah, I like that. So it's short, but you know, fairly sweet teaser. And then we're immediately with Mulder and Scully after the credits, and they're leaving court. And this is something we never saw again, where Mulder and Scully have got a load of case files under their arm, and Mulder makes a joke, doesn't he, about how, you know, he'd be rather out catching aliens or mutants like Tombs than doing this.
Oh yeah, that's it. He says like a perk of working the X-Files is you seldom have the paperwork of like pressing charges or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know people are going to say it's probably all very clunky, but I enjoyed that back and forth, you know, where he's Mulder's like bemused because he reckons he's locked his car or something, and Scully goes, well, you know, straight away, oh, it must be an X-File then. So again, yeah, you're just seeing that they're able to take the piss more with one another. They're less uptight than they were.
That's true. That is quite nice. But what I didn't understand was the court thing, because that's something that we never saw before or since, and it just interests me. I was wondering straight away, well, how often are they doing that? How often do they have to go to court with cases? What was the case itself that made them go to court? Because the X-Files, by their very nature, wouldn't be very things you can prosecute half the time, and that ends up coming into play much later in the show, a little bit when they're audited.
Yeah, are they being brought in, or has Scully been brought in to handle a more, I want to say mundane, but I don't necessarily mean like, cause if it'd have to have some importance for them to be contacted, but maybe right. It isn't X-Files, you know, 24/7 for them.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe at this point.
Just intrigued me because it was something we never saw again, and I just wondered about that. But yeah, you like you say, there is a little bit of nice spark there, and you know they now have the cassette prank, which introduces Phoebe before we see her, in which she suggests there's a bomb in the car and tease that off, which is quite a nice inventive way to introduce a character, to be fair. I did quite like that.
He's very cartoony though, isn't it, as well? Yeah. And I think that kind of like sets the register of her performance in a way. And I agree, it's probably like unintentionally laughing at it kind of humour, but part of me thinks they must know that, you know, they surely they are sending her right up to be this incredibly, unbelievably cut glass English accent, you know, her little phrases like, you know, the poor bastard, you know, burnt to death, we have to catch the dirty bugger. You know, it's just, I just thought it was funny that she approached it with such kind of like relish as the kind of villainess old flame, isn't it? You know, there's, she's kind of like, she knocks off, because we've just seen, sorry, Scully and Mulder together and in a very kind of easygoing manner, she's like, you know, there to disrupt that kind of balance of their relationship.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, I think she's like, I think there is an element of, you know, her being sending up that thing, but I also think there's an element of the fact that Chris Carter just doesn't know what an English person sounds like. I really do think that all the way through this. I think
I'm
to an extent
too much credit. I'm saying there's a level of nuance that possibly isn't there.
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think she I think she might genuinely be like
a realistic portrayal in his mind.
Yeah, and it's just a little bit it's just a little, I mean, I don't like Phoebe, not just because I'm not supposed to like her, because none of us are supposed to like her, because Scully doesn't like her.
And she breaks Mulder's heart again.
Well, yeah, exactly. but immediately you've got all this flirting between these two. And I just was like, Scully's face is perfect because, you know, admittedly, Phoebe goes, she hates me. And I'm thinking, well, yeah. And to be honest, we don't particularly like you either. And he's just like, well, I didn't. I just felt like all the flirting between them straight away. I'm like, oh, no, please don't give me an episode like this. I don't want to sit through this.
But the good thing is you get to see a bit of that kind of bitchiness come out between Scully and Phoebe. Like there's that brilliant scene where they've moved locations now, and that, you know, I'm sure you'll explain how Mulder and Scully get in brought in Phoebe's case. But when Phoebe's leaving the office, Scully just does this tiny little wave to her, doesn't she, to send her off. It's really, really well done.
That was really well pitched, yeah, as if that kind of... And I think that there's an interesting potential drinking game with how many times Phoebe just says a very cut glass goodbye to Scully. She must do it about half a dozen times.
And that obviously comes in at the end, doesn't it, when... you know, Gillian Anderson, being of dual heritage, you know, she can speak an authentic American or English accent. She's able to deliver that perfectly at the, you know, at the very end of the episode, for like humour purposes. I mean, Scully, actually, although she gets sidelined in this episode, she's got some great lines. I think there's one where we're meant to see that kind of like Mulder is not besotted necessarily by Phoebe, but he can't resist helping her, like he doesn't seem to be able to say no to her. And I think Scully just says, I think Mulder says, I was just extending professional courtesy. And she goes, oh, is that what you was extending? And that kind of innuendo, I just thought was so funny coming out of Scully's mouth.
But it made me laugh, but at the same time I went, well, when did this become Carry On X-Files?
Yeah, you know, that's probably why I loved it.
But you see, I do love the Carry On films. I do like innuendo, but I just was like, oh, what? Just, no, it's because I think it's because maybe at the time I would have laughed at this more, but I think it's because I've seen the show do much, much more nuanced, witty comedy than
yes,
this.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, well, this just really feels like a bit snigger. What are you extending, Mulder? I was a bit like, I just don't know. And it just feels out of step. And maybe I'm being a big square, but it just feels out of step. But no, the reason that Phoebe comes is because, as she explains, an arsonist is burning up Parliament members. And it's the family, the Marsdens, Sir Malcolm Marsden and his family, to evade this, because the wife has had these letters and he's in the firing line. To evade this, he's taken them all to Massachusetts for like a summer retreat. So Phoebe's coming over here and he's roping in Mulder. I mean, to be fair, it seems
like... How convenient.
Well, yeah, it does seem like an excuse to really hook up with him again, really. She doesn't necessarily... Even though there's a bit of weirdness to some extent, it's not massively weird. And, you know, it's just an arsonist. It's just a Parliament targeting arsonist. She does it, I think, mainly to hook up with Mulder again, to get an excuse to see him.
Yeah, I think we're led to believe that, at one point later on in the episode, that they might even have a rendezvous in a hotel and things like that. But I'm not entirely sure that is actually ever her motivation. She wants Mulder possibly to think that there's an opportunity, you know, for him to get his oats, so to speak. But we learn later on that she's actually already become involved, hasn't she? She's up to her old tricks, apparently, her old kind of wayward follies of youth with the Mr. Marsden.
She's playing a few games, definitely. She does bring up one thing that Chris Carter, certainly in the early days, liked to do. She mentions how the Windsor Castle fire of 1992 was set by the same arsonist, suggesting that Cecil Lively tried to, you know, set fire to the Queen, basically. And, you know, that was a real fire in 92. Windsor Castle was burnt down, or it was burned badly. I remember that, actually, as a very little young kid. But like with the Challenger disaster in space, which didn't sit well, this isn't the same degree, because the whole Challenger thing really didn't sit well. But this is a bit like, well, you know, I realised he likes to try and weave in real-life events into, like, the X-Files lore. You know, and that was just a throwaway line, she said, but it stuck with me. And I was like, oh, okay. And I, you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. In this case, I suppose it adds a little bit to what Cecil Lively's trying to do. So, you know, Phoebe's with them. She's got the case. She's got them on the case. Mulder's, you know, quite enjoying having her back to an extent. This is where we see Bob, as he calls himself, presumably because Chris Carter couldn't think of a more British name than Bob, right?
Bob the caretaker.
Yeah, Bob the caretaker. And, you know, thank you, Bob. Good God, darling. That painting looks a lot like you. And I was like, seriously?
What a nice chap.
Yeah, what a lovely chap. But when they look at the painting, I was like, it's obviously her. It's like, oh, it looks a lot like you. It's obviously her. It's like, would you not at that point go, that's a bit weird? As in, why someone put a painting of you on the wall? Not like, that looks a lot like you, darling. What a coincidence of all the places. It's like, oh, come on. And then you've got Bob's, when you see that he's actually killed the caretaker, it's such a cheesy line when he says, see, I'm the caretaker now.
I see, because we know he's a bad guy because he kicks a dog or something, doesn't he?
He does, he kicks the dog out of the way and he goes, I'm the caretaker now. And I was like, oh, what?
And you see the hand, don't you, coming out of the ground, yeah.
It's just so cheesy. But actually, around that time, Mulder and Phoebe have gone to see a doctor who starts talking about the ideas about arson, and this sets up the idea that the cause might be rocket fuel. And I'll give this episode that. It does come up with an alternate kind of... And Scully ends up getting on the case with this. An alternate kind of reason as to what might be the trigger for what Cecil can do. You know, this idea that rocket fuel in some kind of liquid.
Oh, that's it, because they're saying... That's it, because it doesn't leave any... That's it. They're saying that what's suspicious is... Everything gets completely incinerated, doesn't it? So there's like nothing left. There's no evidence left of how the fire's been started or anything. You're right. And he obviously, that's another scene that allows Amanda Pays' character Phoebe to be seen as like this femme fatale, because isn't the arsonist expert all kind of like flirting with her and looking at Mulder going, well, I wish I could be in your shoes. You've got to, you know.
The doctor guy, yeah, because he's really eccentric, this guy who talks to them about the arson. He's really eccentric. He seems to be in love with fire.
Yeah, that's it. He says it's got a dark poetry or something like that. Yeah. Some great lines.
And again, it's the little things in the X-Files I didn't notice, but they do try and inflect some of these occasional, like, random guest characters with certain elements of personality. And in this guy, he's a little, he gets a little bit excited at the idea of spontaneous combustion.
And being close to Phoebe, I think.
Yeah, exactly. This is the point where Mulder first floats the name, the term pyrokinesis as a possibility, but at this point it's not fully set in stone, really. So, you know, once this has all been established, you've got the point where Mulder basically says to Scully, don't worry about being part of this. I'll deal with it with Phoebe. But he also mentions this, the biggest problem I think I have with this episode, which is his crippling fear of fire. Now, the problem I have with this, okay, there haven't been massive loads of episodes where he's been, you know, encountering blazes. You know, this isn't Backdraft. It's not that kind of show. But it's never mentioned before. To my knowledge, it is never brought up again, right, in the entire show. And there's definitely points later on in the show where he encounters a bomb or fire or something like flame. And it's never, ever referenced again. And my whole thing with this is, yes, okay, Chris Carter wanted to throw one of his own things in, right, to, you know, make Mulder more randy. But I'm like, well, if you're going to do that, actually maybe follow through on it. And I think maybe with the benefit of hindsight, I've got more of a problem with this.
Yeah, you're right. I guess it's throwing things in possibly at this early stage that he doesn't know whether he's going to develop it or not. He's not thinking necessarily about the bigger picture, I guess. But you're right. Actually, now you've pointed it in that light, it undermines massively any kind of potential for gravitas in those scenes now, like, you know, towards the end of the episode, which obviously all builds up towards, because if it is just like a kind of throwaway thing that's only there for this particular episode, it kind of diminishes it somewhat.
Exactly. And this is the problem I have with it. I'm also not entirely sure he would have spent 10 years roughly getting over Phoebe, which is effectively what he says to Scully. I mean, yeah, okay, she's quite attractive, and she presumably was, you know, quite a mind gamer, and you probably had a lot of quite kinky fun sex with her, Oxford, in fairness, right?
I was going to say, on apparently atop of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's grave, which is just like a bizarre like image that they would bring that up as something to reminisce about. But well, again, that ties in with all the Holmes and Watson references in this episode between Mulder and Scully.
There is a lot of that in here. They really knock it. I mean, you know, they are in many ways the modern day Holmes and Watson, Mulder and Scully. You know, you could apply them in terms of mythology in that way, but this really whacks it over the head that they are. Yeah, I just don't know if he's, given everything else that's gone on in his life, given all the hunt for Samantha, given the X-Files, given the, you know, everything else in his life, I don't think he would have spent a long time pining over Phoebe, because in the last, like, 5 years or so, especially after the point of Unusual Suspects, which we later see in season 5, where he became even more paranoid and everything like that, I just think that he's had more on his plate, plus the fact he may well have been married. I mean, this all comes in later, you know, the whole Diana Fowley stuff and everything. But there's big suggestions that he was married, right, in between this point anyway. So I just don't know. It's all stuff that isn't then, for me, it isn't really there beforehand and it isn't followed through. It just feels like it's just there for the purpose of this story.
Well, again, it's that kind of almost filler mentality that we were talking about when we talked about even that. In that case, it worked in terms of that was a satisfying kind of standalone episode. Whereas you're right, that these things are kind of being thrown in, but ultimately, I guess, in retrospect, they felt the show, or they came to regard it as a bit of filler. Because I think she was a character that they were going to bring back. Is that right? Because I remember reading that she was meant to be someone they might think of as a recurring role. And I think, you know, she'd been in The Kindred, like an 80s horror film that I enjoyed. And she'd also been in, I think she's been in both iterations, actually, of the Flash TV show. But for whatever reason, I think they just think it didn't work then? Like, they were aware that the episode had inherent problems, and possibly her dynamic with Mulder and, you know, her and chemistry with David Duchovny was one of them, possibly.
Yeah, there was a lot of disappointment about it, ultimately. There's quite a bit about how they didn't think it worked at all between Mulder and Phoebe. James Wonger said it didn't play at all, and that should have been the subtext of the whole show. They had to cut a lot, like I said before, between them. They cut a lot from the episode. So I think maybe at the outset, Chris Carter might well have wanted Phoebe to reappear, and I think he did. I think that was the. I think after this, they went, nah.
Yeah, let's bury it.
Yeah, it doesn't
so
work.
So like, that's where the pathological fear of fire got buried along with it.
Yeah.
It ended up being a bit of a sore spot for him, possibly. Yeah, that's interesting, because like you said, I think there's been worse episodes already, like in the first season. So it is interesting to hear that this is such a, you know, this one could be such a source of embarrassment. I mean, I'm thinking about the AI episode.
That wasn't great.
Potentially Jersey Devil.
Yeah, Jersey Devil, Space, Ghost in the Machine. They're all
Space, yeah.
They're all worse. Space, definitely. They're all worse than this. you know, this does have bits, you know, to sell it. I mean, one of the big things is this main celebrity spot. I mean, Amanda Pays is quite well known, but the main celebrity spot nowadays is Mark Shepherd, as we've mentioned before. And he here gets a little bit more exploration in a few scenes. We see the definite sexualized nature of what Cecil Lively's doing when he's looking. You get quite a bit of slow motion work as he's looking at Mrs. Marsden in the garden.
Yeah, and that's definitely, and like when he's like caressing that wall and he's looking at her fondling various kind of pots, and you know she's in slow motion. It's very much fetishizing her torso and her chest, and like for a moment I was thinking, yeah, this has got the potential to be much more kind of dark and adult. And even the kind of psychological profile that Scully comes up with to kind of, you know, diagnose him, as it were, is much more kind of like adult thing. You know, it is really kind of touching upon some, you know, I was just, you know, things that don't seem to gel with the rest of the episode. Like his motivation is quite chilling, and it is more adult in the sense of it being, you know, like sexualized. And I think, just like Eve, you were saying that Eve could be a far more kind of suspenseful, scary episode. This could have been a lot more, you know, hard-nosed and a lot more kind of like, I could have just had a lot more power to it, I guess, whereas really it all just gets diffused, doesn't it? The fire gets extinguished because of some of the wonky writing and performances.
I couldn't agree more. I think tonally they completely get the wrong end of the stick with this. And yet Mark Shepherd himself has said that he, even though he enjoyed it a lot, bit playing this part, he didn't understand why a lot of that motivation you mentioned about the sexualized and pursuing women isn't there. You know, it's hinted at. You know, if anything, he seems more motivated to kind of mess with, you know, the heads of the two children than the wife.
That was well done, actually. I thought that scene where he kind of like is coercing them to try the cigarette. I mean, again, it's really, would it necessarily need to be there? But I think it kind of underlines his sort of mean streak, and it just, he is able to kind of like instill his character, although a lot of it's with like exaggerated eye movement and facial expressions. He's kind of chilling, isn't he, in the role?
Yeah, no, he is. And Mark Shepherd throughout this is great, I think. You know, he really sells the part. There's the scene in the bar where he the well-known, almost iconic X-Files moment now with a monster, where he sets the bar on fire with his hand, and then the flame just like that. And that's the first moment you really see what he's able to do. You know, and he gets a few really cool moments like that where he's very much playing the role with a bit of fun in him. Now, that's great, and I've got no issue with that slight, you know, kind of calculating element to him. But I think that he could have had a lot more, you know, creepy, weird, dark motivation that they don't explore.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a lot more kind of the stalking and the voyeuristic undertones that are very much in those scenes that we were saying earlier where he's spying on the wife.
Yeah, and I also don't really understand why he does that in the bar. If he's trying not to draw attention to himself and he's trying to inveigle his way in so he can burn Malcolm Marsden to the ground, why does he actually set a bar on fire and then give Mulder and Phoebe the, you know, the opportunity to understand a man, you know, he's effectively burned himself up, right, in a bar? Because he ends up burning himself, doesn't he, to prove that he can, you know, he's invulnerable.
Yeah, I mean, there is this whole kind of weird showmanship aspect of him almost being like a villain out of an X-Men film, I guess, like looking back in hindsight. But they try to rationalise it that he's maladjusted and he lacks like social skills or something, and isn't it something about his feelings of inadequacy, so he ends up having these kind of like momentary acts of bravado, I guess, like misguided in some way. I mean, it's all kind of cod psychology. I don't think they're really attempting to get fully under the skin, but you're right. It's just obviously, if he's meant to be like a criminal mastermind that's been able to carry this on undetected for so long, it is kind of a strange thing to do in that incident.
Yeah, it is a little bit. And I think it works better, like you said, when he's trying to corrupt the boys, you know, and that he does the magic trick of the cigarette. And, you know, you know what struck me, and like I said, we don't know much about who he is really and his background. But what struck me is, I wonder if he was child abused, the character, because there's just something about the way he like messes with those kids' heads that suggests to me that maybe that happened to him. You know, and later on you get a lot of hints that he quite possibly was involved in a satanic cult later on, because there's a really protracted bit of backstory about the name Cecil Lively, about somebody who died in a fire in the early 70s, and that there was a connection to some satanic rituals going on in Somerset, which boys were involved in. And I did start to thinking, they don't really connect all the dots with that, but there's suggestions of possible backstory to this guy. And I kept thinking, well, maybe that's what he's about. Maybe he had this really fucked up childhood, and then he's ended up, it's partly sexualized his behavior, but it's also partly made him enjoy getting off on twisting these children.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, there's the potential for cliche with that kind of rationalization of someone's, you know, why people do bad things as adults. But you're right, in some respects, that might be more interesting than what they did in terms of it just being almost like moustache-twiddling villain, isn't it? Because yeah, by the end, he's almost like a comical bad guy, the way he kind of like clicks his fingers to set the corridor ablaze in the house. And, you know, he obviously delivers that line, doesn't he, at the end where you see him with all his face disfigured and like all his lips a mess, and he says, oh, I'm dying for a cigarette, when he's in that kind of like iron lung machine.
That is one of the best final lines, though, of anything ever. I do love that. I mean, he is really cheesy, but I'm just dying for a cigarette. He's just brilliant. It's those little, oh, great. I think you get more of a look, really, into the potential psychology of the guy through Scully. And, the episode has to work to keep her involved. While Mulder and Phoebe are off doing their thing, and mainly just flirting with each other, to be honest, Scully's actually trying to put a few pieces together, and she starts doing some more of a handy let's catch up with the plot log entries in order to here try and get into the psychology. And, you know, she says at one point, she's talking about, you know, the possible sexualized nature of arsonist killers and everything. She says, he will be very clever and plan his crimes very well. And I thought, well, he doesn't seem to have done that, particularly for me. You know, he's inveigled himself into a few places, sure, but then he doesn't strike me as somebody who's a master planner and a master villain, because he does some really reckless and odd things.
Impulsive things, yeah. Right. I mean, isn't it like the first time we see him in America, he's actually like painting the house, isn't it? Like, we learn that he's actually painting the exterior with rocket fuel or something, but he's doing it in plain view. I mean, surely that would smell.
Well, you'd think so, yeah. You would think so. There's just a few. He's just too oddball in his behaviour to really, for me, he'd stand out. I just think he'd stand out, and some of the things he does.
And he seems to enjoy that, doesn't he? I guess he's like charismatic aspect to him is that he just seems to be so. He has like got this exuding confidence that he'll just get away with it. He's quite happy to dispose of, you know, the driver, so he can, you know, be asked to take the kids to and the family to, you know, the party. It all seems to be come easy to him, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And that bravado is obviously part of his character. So, you know, you can accept that in one sense, and Shepard's performance, but at the same time, it doesn't track with potentially being this master arsonist for me. And so the script is trying to work hard to get you to believe something that I don't think is there personally. But obviously, this is the party you mentioned is where they all go to. Mulder and Phoebe are there because they're concerned that Marsden's still a target. And this is basically an excuse to get David Duchovny in a dinner jacket, really.
and then later in like a bathrobe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then it's just, there's two reasons, I think, for this whole thing. The first one is to get him and Phoebe to kiss, really, and have a bit of a romantic dance. And, you know, they talk about how this is supposed to explore his days at Oxford. I don't think it does. It gives a tether to the days, which is a really interesting piece of Mulder's backstory. This whole thing, he went to Oxford University, and he was all part of him being a real, genuine high flyer, potentially, which he all screws up when he goes on the X-Files and becomes a lunatic in people's minds. But I don't really feel like you get much of a sense of him being at Oxford just because this bit of posh British totty comes back into his life and he starts flirting with him. That's not exploration.
No, I mean, I guess, isn't it also that it's another way that you can show Mulder as like an ordinary hero, like for the audience to root for, in the sense that, you know, he's getting the better of by this woman, you know, he's getting his hopes up and it's all going to, you know, end up with him being hurt again. And then obviously that ties in with the fact that he's also unable to be the traditional hero character and save the kids when a fire breaks out at the party. Yeah. Because then obviously, Bob's able to come in and act as if he's the hero to further, you know, his cause within the family's affections. And it's like, you kind of, he's got flaws, I guess. And sometimes that's interesting, isn't it, in itself? Like, the Mulder isn't he definitely isn't a whole martial art 80s action heroes. He's much more of a lineage of like the heroes that are ordinary men that bleed, you know, that were started by you know, things like Die Hard, I guess, you know, with Bruce Willis.
Yeah.
So I don't know, I guess like in some respects those things kind of work, and it allows us to, it creates a situation where we can see that Scully doesn't like seeing Mulder with somebody else, or doesn't like seeing Mulder being abused by someone else. So again, it adds another potential, always there, an attraction more than just within the professional sense between them.
I think this is the first episode where you really get a sense of that. You know, that moment where Scully actually sees them kissing, there's a look on her face that's a mixture of jealousy and just basically, oh, for fuck's sake, you're supposed to be on a case, right? You know, and then when the alarm goes off, she's just like, there's an alarm, there's a fire, as if to say, yeah, stop kissing, get on with your jobs, right? And it's really good because, you know, they don't really know what to say. And yeah, that was the other flip side of it, you know, Mulder's fear. And you're right, it does humanise him a bit, and it is good in that sense. You know, I think that you make a good point with that there. Even if I don't think it's executed particularly well, it does work in that sense. But then, I wanted Scully to call them both out on what they were doing when they should have been working. You know, there's a nice bit of steel when Scully and Mulder and Phoebe are talking afterwards. You know, I wanted her to call them out. But she doesn't. To her credit, she doesn't. She's not letting it get to her, even if it has. And there was a suggestion that it has. But, you know, that's very Scully in that she wouldn't let it show, really, which makes a lot of sense. It's at this point she obviously gives all that information about, you know, Cecil's potential past, and they ultimately get the connection that it's pretty much Bob from the house. And Mulder gets back to the house, and he's and Phoebe's having a bit of smoochy time with Marsden. So she is playing games, as you said earlier.
Oh,
she is
boom,
playing games.
This.
Yeah, she's evil. Ooh. I thought now this basically leads to the ending where Scully's made the connection that the rocket fuel is part of the trigger for this, and this is how he's basically doing it. But I thought, I don't know if you've seen this film, but the ending of this reminded me of Patriot Games. The ending of Patriot Games.
Oh, I've not seen that for years. That's the Harrison Ford film, yeah?
It is. And it's, you know, it's a relatively okay film, but the last, like, 30 minutes are absolutely brilliant. And it's this really protracted under siege where these IRA killers come to this house on the edge of, like, in somewhere like Cape Cod, actually. And, you know, the hero Jack Ryan, Harrison Ford, is there protecting a British royal family, and you know, there's some agents, and they're under siege, and then it ends up with this amazing boat chase. I mean, it really is fantastic. I mean, it shocked me actually how great it is. This isn't obviously as good as that, but you know, it did make me think it's a similar. And this wasn't long after Patriot Games, so I do wonder. That was 92, so I do wonder if Chris Carter had seen that film and liked it and took a cue from that. Actually,
yeah. And when was Backdraft then? Because obviously you were joking earlier, but you were talking about obviously some of the great stunts.
That was 91. So yeah.
Right.
I think those are a couple of influences as well on the back of Chris Carter's mind, definitely. So yeah, it basically leads to that kind of scenario. You know, there's another fire. Cecil's got that house under siege. We find the driver of the car pretty much immolated in the toilet. Although, did nobody think to look for that
guy?
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, that's another like nasty little beat to the episode where he's been melted, yeah, isn't he, onto the toilet seat. And, you know, his face is all blackened and everything.
But this is the thing, though. There's a couple of things. There could have been so much more of that kind of stuff in this episode. So much more of that kind of really twisted kind of focus. Because there are moments when it does that. And I also thought, again, the children are trapped in that fire. This has happened twice now. Wouldn't it have made more sense if it was the woman in some sort of twisted, sexualized way who was in danger, if it was Mrs. Marsden?
Yeah, or like if you're going really sort of down the chilling route, it would fit with the behaviour of certain sexualized serial killers where they, you know, they kidnap and violate the women and then they burn the bodies.
Yeah.
So if you really wanted to kind of go down a darkened route and have it as like a serial killer episode based in some kind of, you know, the rising popularity of the kind of psychological thriller that was happening post Silence of the Lambs, yeah, you could have had it that we found out that actually, you know, that the women were found burnt, you know, after that, you know, the husband would die first, and then like maybe months or weeks later, the wives were, you know, were found, and it would have just been a lot more chilling,
yeah,
wouldn't it? And then he could have played it less tongue in cheek, and it would have been much more about, you know, a real kind of menacing, sexually obsessive, predatory.
That would have been really, really interesting. And I think, you know, in later seasons, they might have gone down more of that road when they were a bit more sure of the kind of show they were doing, even in season two.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. They're still finding their feet and they're still kind of pushing boundaries. And even with these clunkers, I think whenever I've heard people talk about it who were very much watching it as it broadcast, they still felt it was like completely unlike anything else they were watching. Like even when it had these more sort of bum notes.
Yeah, well, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it's it does have elements, but ultimately this finale, this final bit, is an excuse for Cecil to go full on comic book villain, you know, click his fingers, and then you've got like loads of fire, Mulder facing his demons, yeah, saves the children, whatever.
Well, he takes him a while. He couldn't do it at the hotel, and he has to do it now, doesn't he? Yeah, he has to. Now that he's got, like, Phoebe off his mind, of course, and he's all business again, you know, he's able to overcome that vulnerability and that kind of, like, fear of the fire. And didn't he burn his hand or something? I mean, you see it in the episode.
Yeah.
Isn't there some story that he actually did get a real, you know, he did actually injure himself, David Duchovny, on set?
Yeah, I think he did, yeah. So, you know, there was some good, you know, some people doing their own stunts and stuff on this. I just didn't care. Unfortunately, I just didn't care. I just wasn't invested. It's not what Mulder's... It just didn't feel right for me. It felt forced for me. But it's worth it maybe for Cecil's final sort of ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha as he's burning it alive. And he's like, you can't kill me! Ha-ha-ha-ha! Oh my God. This is a comic book.
And again, yeah. What is this? What was the purpose of that again? Apart from obviously he has a massive, grandiose exhibition of his power. Why is he burning himself to a cinder? That's his method of escape.
I think it's because there's rocket fuel on him, and previously he doesn't do that. The accelerant isn't on him.
Yes, no, that's it. I've remembered now, because in a nice little touch, I guess, bringing the women together, the adversaries for Mulder, Phoebe and Scully, they come together because, isn't it, that Scully's held in Bob at gunpoint. Mm. But, you know, she can't shoot him in case, the whole house or everyone gets blown up. But Phoebe chucks the accelerant onto him whilst before he leaves the house. Yeah, I remember.
So now he's basically hoist by his own petard, really. You know, the accelerant then triggers all that in him. And even though it doesn't kill him, as we later see that he's in the hyperbaric chamber and, you know, he comes out with the one-liner still, he's burnt to a
cinder. Yes, he's got regenerative skin, hasn't he? Yeah, so he is very much like a mutant then.
Yeah, so... The big question is, would you have wanted to see a sequel? I mean, I think you could have a very interesting second run at Cecil Lively, or you could have done. And I think if they'd have got their ducks in a row with it and made him a little bit more darker and twisted, I think you could have had a nice, an interesting sequel. You know, Fired. Maybe.
Yeah, I think I'd rather have seen the episode that you're talking about, you know, where they actually did get this right in terms of the backstory, the romantic love triangle, the chemistry between, you know, the female guest star and David Duchovny, and the much more serious horror-leaning interpretation of, like, this sexual predator. I think that... That's that would have been more, I think, of the episode that I want to see rather than a sequel. And I guess because they didn't get it right first time round, then that's why they didn't return.
No, I think that's exactly it. Yeah, they realised that it had potential, but they dropped the ball slightly. So that's Fire, basically, and it doesn't make me burn with excitement, if I'm honest. Sorry, I've got to get a few more in there before we go. I just find it all a bit silly, a bit cheesy, and I think the X-Files has before and will do better. So that's Fire. Moving on then, I'm going to ask you the question, Lee, that I ask everybody. Do you believe in, and in this case, I'm going to ask you simply, do you believe in pyrokinesis? Which, as you said, was a term that was coined by Stephen King in his novel Firestarter. But it does have a basis in parapsychology as a psychic ability that allows people to create and control fire with the mind. There have been alleged cases, but they have sometimes been said to be hoaxes. Do you think that this is something that could really happen, or is it more of a comic book kind of power?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously so associated, I guess, with certain comic book characters now. I don't think it would happen, because part of me thinks, isn't it kind of like counter evolutionary? Like, wasn't one of the great advances in, like, human civilization where we learnt to start fires, like as Neanderthal men, and we kind of, that kind of fed into our ability to use tools and, you know, seek out technology to assist us, because we don't have those kind of innate abilities. You know, we've learnt to marshal the elements, but we still can't necessarily originate them. And I guess if you could, wouldn't that kind of take out some of our own drive in that area to be kind of inventive? So you'd end up becoming Obviously, it'd be fantastic for a while, but you'd end up actually being superseded by other species, I guess. So I think if I was looking at it from a trying to be like a serious, but I mean, obviously the answer is no, plain and simple. But if I was trying to kind of think about it in more depth, I wouldn't even be sure that would be something that ultimately would be a good ability to have long term.
Yeah.
What do you?
Well, think? I agree. I think it is probably the realms of science fiction. You know, it's the kind of thing that you see in like the kind of mutant comic book things, like X-Men and whatnot, of people who have triggered mutant abilities. You know, and there are theories that we haven't unlocked all our potential yet psychically. You know, and that, you know, there could be a lot of other things. But everything that has been acclaimed to potentially be pyrokinesis has ultimately been written off as magicians' hoaxes. You know, there have been a few examples, like people to look up potentially if you're interested. People like A.W. Underwood, who was in the 19th century, supposedly could set items ablaze, and Daniel Douglas Home, who was a medium who could perform fire feats and things like this. But they are all usually written off as either using some sort of scientific chemical to aid their trickery, and there's nothing that's ever been conclusively proven as the ability to create fire with your mind, or you know. So I think it's probably either hoaxes or, you know, just a bit of magician's trickery. And yeah, I don't think it would be a good thing, really. Certainly not if you were as bonkers as Cecil Lively. I don't think that would go down well. Okay, so finally then, it's time for the X quiz. You got 3 out of 6 last time, Lee.
Yeah, James, thanks for reminding me. Still my least favourite part of coming on, but
it's everyone's least favourite part. It's why I do it. It's the punishment at the end of fun. Can't all be fun. So are you ready to tackle 5 questions and a quote from Fire?
Oh, go ahead. This is where I wish for like Mulder's ability, you know, where he delivers that horrendous line where he says, "Oh, I'm burdened with a photographic memory." To Phoebe, that's why, you know, it still hurts him to see her again.
What a horrible burden that is, though. You know. Okay, question one. How far outside of London is Bosham, the village in the teaser, stated to be?
God, I think you might have even have said this, actually, but again, I've got no idea. I'm going to say 200 miles.
A bit too far. It's 70 miles, which is roughly accurate for West Sussex, really, I would say. That's not too bad. I don't know where 200 miles would get you. Probably.
Probably into the sea.
If you're going that way, definitely, yeah. Okay, question two. What does Phoebe at one point suggest Mulder can't resist? And I'll give you a clue. It's linked to Sherlock Holmes. Okay.
Oh, yeah, like a 3-pipe problem or something?
Yes. Yeah. Well done, there you go. Can't resist a 3-pipe problem. It's all the little Sherlock references that pepper the episode. Okay, question three. Where did Mulder and Phoebe have their indiscretion on a misty night?
Oh, bollocks. This is where that she was going on about, you know, having sex on Arthur Conan Doyle's grave. It begins with W, doesn't it?
It does. It does.
Oh, God, right. I'm going to say Wiltshire.
Do you know what? I'm tempted to give you a point for that, right?
Okay,
because
it's
Windlesham. And you know, I'm going to give you a point because I think you got the W and you were heading in the right direction.
And
you
taking
guessed
pity on me for being like, you know, the dunce of the class.
Admittedly. But but you did also guess the scene they were talking about with Arthur Conan Doyle. So, yeah, I'm going to give you a point for that. I think you've
got
enough.
Okay, we'll go with it.
It was Windlesham, but yeah. Number four. What's the aviation fuel Mulder finds in the Marsden's garage called? What's the scientific name for it? It's on the tin.
Yeah, I'm not going to get this. The only thing I can think of is like petroleum, but obviously that's not going to be it. But that'll be my answer.
Okay, it's not quite true. It's argotypoline.
Right, okay.
Yeah, there you go. That's the name of the rocket fuel. Question five. Where did the ritual satanic sacrifices Scully mentions take place?
Now, Somerset, because you said that earlier.
I did. Can you tell me outside of where? There is a name for the place, but I can accept a point if you tell me outside of where.
Oh, right, sorry, it's not, you're not after Somerset. That's not going to get me the point on this occasion. Right, it was outside Somerset. You're talking about like a building then, are you saying? Or
I'll give you outside a city, outside a town. But it is in Somerset, you're right.
Yeah, this is only going to embarrass me further, not of my spatial geography, getting the 200 miles question wrong, and now I don't even know. my mind's gone blank for somewhere in Somerset. So I don't know.
All right, I'll tell you, it was the Tottingham Woods outside of Bath.
Oh, okay.
Yes, Bath is a lovely place in Somerset.
I'm wishing ice could spontaneously combust now. Out of embarrassment.
Well, you've got one more chance to equal your score from last time. So this is the quote. You're on 2 out of 5. Here we go. Right, here's the quote. Obviously, if you can name who it is and what scene, that's even better. Okay. Here we go. Time to call 911.
Time to call 911? Oh, God. I thought you'd come up with something more memorable than that, because there were some good lines in the episode, even if they were of more humorous variety. Jesus.
It depends how you say it and what scene it's in.
Right, because okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm really sorry.
That's all right. I'll tell you. It's when Cecil is about to burn the corridor at the end. And he's just before he clicks his fingers, he goes, "Time to call 911. And then he goes,
right, okay.
Like that. And the way he says it is really, you know, cheeky. So never mind. You didn't do too bad. You got two out of five.
I think that's... I'm just proving your point, actually. This episode is a lot more disposable than I first thought.
And my quizzes are horrible. That's the other point you're proving.
So what did I get on this one then, too? So I'm two out of six.
Yeah. it's a scale you can, it's a sliding scale. There's, you know, you could knock it out the park next time you're on. So
yeah, I suppose it could be like cumulative points, you know, overall, you know, and I'll get one every time. Go for the total score.
Just keep going up, not down. That's the plan. Okay, well, so that's all we have for Fire then this week. It's been a particularly clammy episode, I think, with quite a bit of sweat on the brow. I'm going to stop now. This is terrible. But I just want to thank you, Lee, for joining me again for this episode. Thanks for coming back on.
Yeah, pleasure. Always enjoyable to, you know, get other people's views on the episodes. And I think, by and large, you have talked me around that I might have been slightly generous to this. But I guess it's because... you know, they're just entertaining shows to watch. They don't always have to be the best, and it had some memorable moments, but a case of, you know, unfulfilled potential, sadly, on this one.
Yeah, I think so. But you know, everyone's got different views in it, and there are things to enjoy. So as long as you enjoy it, that's the important thing with the X-Files.
Yeah, and it's certainly going to get better quickly, because there's some really good episodes coming up, isn't it? So they'll be great to listen to.
The next one in particular, absolutely. So. Until we see you again, where can we find you around online?
If you'd like to hear me discuss films of many different varieties, that would be over at moviematterspodcast.com, or just search for Movie Matters Podcast on iTunes. And if you've got any interest in the video game hobby, then you can hear me on, and many other people, on Lapse Gamer Radio, which is like very much a team effort community about getting lapsed gamers back into playing more, and that can be found on iTunes as well, Lapsed Game Radio.
Tremendous. Check them both out, guys, because they're fantastic. That'd be brilliant. We're, as ever, on Twitter at @thex_cast, and we're on Facebook at @thexcast. We're on iTunes. Do subscribe if you haven't already. That'd be lovely if you could. And we're part of the Black Hole Media Podcast Network at Black Hole Media on Twitter. So check out all our other podcasts about film and TV. There's some cool stuff on there if you're interested. So you'll be back later on in the season, Lee, for a couple of more episodes, including the finale, hopefully.
Okay, well, yeah, fingers crossed that we can sync up like the schedules, but no, that'd be good to be able to round off the first season, at least having done the pilot. But I'm more than happy to kind of make room going forward for, you know, your other guests who know a lot more about the X-Files than me to take up the mantle of doing the first and end episode. But I'm happy just to, you know, come in whenever needed.
You've opened a nice trap door there that you can and for people to climb through. So thanks, it'd be great to have you whenever you can make it. That'd be lovely. So thanks for listening, guys, and remember, as ever, until next time, trust no one.